I wondered how it was like to be large brown creature with no constraint. Now I feel bad to have wondered. Now I know. Is not good. Is not very happy to feel like this. Man Monster opens door and I am much relieved. He sits down on step next to me. He makes noise like, ay, ay, ay. I am very ashamed to have made waste in house. I know when I did this I was not a good companion. But also I do not want to be a creature who is not allowed back in house. I look at him and make face like, please do not condemn me from house. I can be a very good companion from now on. I will be always good to you from now on. I know Man Monster is not always smart about discerning meaning, but hopefully this time he will discern. Man Monster scratches my back and he makes noise like, Rufus, Rufus, Rufus. And I know that noise Rufus can mean many things. Sometimes Rufus means, I am happy to see you. And sometimes it means, I am upset. And this time, I discern that it means both things at once. Somehow this time when Man Monster makes noise like, Rufus, 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 it is like all the other Rufuses combined together. It means all the things. It means, well, here we are. And it means, yep. And it means, why? And, what do we do now? It means, good dog. And it means, bad dog. And it means, let me scratch your back for you. Man Monster makes noise like, Rufus, Rufus, Rufus. And he scratches my back, and I love him. I love him with everything I am. I love him like he's a part of myself.
Rules for Taboo, read by Emma Galvin and Will Brill. Draw a card. The word at the top is the word you want your teammate to say. The other words are the taboo words you cannot use while trying to get your teammate to guess your word. You must make your teammate guess your word without using the taboo words.
For example, if your word is tall, you cannot say short, big, height, size, or tails, but you can say, this is the smallest drink at Starbucks, or your mother in heels, or last night at Kristen's party, you talked with that good-looking law student in the cocktail dress who was so strikingly this for over an hour, and when I told you I wanted to go home, you said, just give me 20 more minutes, and I said, I'd really like to leave, and you said, can you please just be patient, and I thought, that was a real this kind of order. A real this kind of order indeed, Steve.
If your word is bed, you cannot say blanket, pillow, sleep, room, or head. But you can say our this has blue sheets, or on Sundays we strip the this and put the blue sheets in the laundry and replace them with the peach-colored sheets. You can also say, sometimes, Jillian, if I think too much about us before going to this, I have dreams about dragging a car through a snowstorm. What do you suppose that means, Jillian? I guess it might mean I shouldn't think so much about us before going to this, but it's difficult when we share a this, when you're right there in the this with me, but you seem so far away.
If your word is breakfast, you cannot say meal, morning, pancake, club, or Tiffany's, but you can say, it was over this at the Skylight Diner on 34th Street that you and I decided to move in together. We had taken a crack-of-dawn train into Penn Station from your parents' house in Ronkonkoma. You had an omelet, Steve, and I had a bowl of fruit. You said, it's stupid that we're paying rent on two different apartments. And I smiled and blushed. To us, the future seemed an endless web of possibilities, like the many-branched line of the Long Island Railroad.
If your word is park, you can say, it was in Fort Greene this where I first realized I loved you, Jillian. It was August, and we bought a copy of the Sunday paper to read out in the this, and you took a nap under a red oak. And when the shadow moved and the sun hit your face, you flinched and then smiled. And I realized that's what I wanted. Just like that, forever. And it occurred to me right there in the this, that I had fallen for you completely. I was irreparably head over heels for this woman who, 2 months earlier, had slid up next to me, drunk, at a party, and, as if she knew me, slurred into my ear, you deserve someone who will love you in all your damaged glory.
If your word is change, You can say, "This is what I did." Gradually. Imperceptibly. I can't say how exactly. But I'm not the same person you fell in love with in Fort Greene Park that Sunday in August. It's an old cliche that women break up with men because they think they'll this, and they don't. And men break up with women because they think they won't this, and they do. But is there also a cliche about why men and women stay together? You can say that, sure. But why would you want to? You may be better off passing. You can say pass, and your teammate can groan. And you can say, "I'm sorry, Steve, I don't want to do that one." And besides, you can say, "This game is stupid. I hate this stupid game. Next time, we're playing Jenga."
If your word is tomorrow, you cannot say day, today, yesterday, after, or future. There are a whole lot of things you can't say. But you can say, "This terrifies me and I don't know why. Maybe I'm just weak. Maybe we're both so incredibly weak."
If your word is eyes, you cannot say face, nose, glasses, see, or soul, but you can say, "Last night I looked into your these, and I hit a wall. I can make out nothing past the iris, and I realized that the deep, unquenchable yearning I long thought I had recognized was actually my own. How foolish of me. How foolish of us all."
You can pass, and then your teammate can pass, and then you can thank your guests for coming and for the cheesecake they brought. And as you clear the wine glasses from the living room, you can say, "This was fun," in an absent tone that makes it clear that you don't really mean it, but you don't exactly not mean it either. And before you crawl off to your blue-sheeted bed, you can pack up the game and put it back on a shelf in the living room closet, where you don't have to look at it until you drag it out for the next party. Where you don't even have to think about it.
Up and Comers, read by Stephanie Beatriz. "Do you ever think maybe you're overthinking things?" Lizzie asked. We were getting breakfast together, as we often did, the morning after a very long night, as we'd often had. She was nursing a black eye, as she often was, and we were both nursing hangovers, as we almost always were, and we were talking about a boy who'd asked me out on a date, and we were weighing the pros and cons of me going out with him. "I do think I'm overthinking things," I said. "I think that all the time, but then I think, what if I'm not overthinking things? What if I'm just regular thinking things, but then I think I'm overthinking things because I subconsciously want to let myself off the hook?" Lizzie stirred the vodka into her coffee. "You might be overthinking things." I shrugged a shrug and said, "Yeah, well." "You know what I think, Porkchop?" Lizzie had started calling me Porkchop recently as a reference to an inside joke I was now too embarrassed to admit I didn't remember. "I think you're afraid of putting yourself out there because you're afraid of getting hurt, because you are, and I believe this is the clinical term, a fucking coward." "Okay, well, first of all, I'm not a coward. I actually saved the world from subterranean bioterrorists just this week." Lizzie scrunched up her face in her trademark Lizzie who gives a shit scowl. "Yeah, but that's like a Tuesday for you. You have super strength and photon blast. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's awesome that you did that, but when's the last time you did something that actually scared you?" This is a story about superheroes, kind of. I mean, I guess that's the stuff that everyone wants to hear about. The crazy powers and colorful villains and us all working together to vanquish evil and all that. But actually, this is a story about a rock band. Before everything went to shit, Clay used to say he never asked to be a superhero. He just wanted to be a rock star. Well, that's true of me too, I guess, except I didn't even really want to be a rock star. I just wanted to get drunk. I was 23 years old, and I was living in the Mission, and I was scraping by with a hostess job at a restaurant that specialized in olive-based dishes, and I had a couple summer dresses that I didn't look completely terrible in, and everything was going fine, like, depressingly so, like, things were so fine I wanted to kill myself. I had somehow fallen into the habit of playing piano for this five-piece alt-folk fuzz-punk shoecore collective called the Up and Comers, and I guess we were starting to get pretty good as far as getting a lot of likes on Instagram and people paying attention to us and writing nice things about us in indie music blogs and SF Weekly and things like that, and we were talking about going on tour. Clay, drums, cowbell, had some friends up in Portland, and he thought they could get us a gig there, and then we could do like a whole Pacific Northwest thing. I'd never been to Portland, and I had saved up some vacation days at Why Not Take All of Me. And things had just kind of fizzled out with this girl I'd been seeing. The less said about her, the better. So I was all for the idea, even though privately I often wondered if maybe the up-and-comers weren't actually all that good as far as, you know, actually being any good. "I'm so over the whole touring thing," said Joelle. "Lead folks, strong opinions. I did it with my last band. You spend a lot of money on gas and you play a lot of empty bars and then you come home and no one remembers you. We should focus on building our fan base in the Bay Area while we've got some momentum. Besides," she added, "Oregon sucks." So we didn't get to Portland. Instead, we stayed in San Francisco and opened for Fuck Shit Piss Karate at Brick and Mortar Music Hall again, and I tried to figure out what I really wanted to be doing with my life because I was pretty sure it wasn't this. For some reason, I had this idea that I was really special and that I was put here to do something really great and important, but the longer I kept living, the more it just seemed like, nope, I'm just kind of a normal person, just like everybody else. That's when Mutt Wang told us about this battle of the bands he'd heard about up near Tahoe. Mutt was a guy Lizzie knew from college. He called himself our manager, but mostly what that meant was he would wear a tie to our gigs and buy us whole drinks. We had kind of a regular audience at this point, including Lizzie's girlfriend Kathleen, Iris's weird uncle who always wore a captain's hat and asked us to call him the Mariner, welcome to San Francisco, and like half a dozen guys who all thought they were Joelle's boyfriend, but sometimes we'd play shows and Mutt would be the only person there sitting by himself in a booth in the back and smiling dumbly when we played Not Hardly as if he'd never heard it before. The most striking thing about the guy was how decent he was, like how he'd always be the first person to ask you if you were cold and do you want to wear his coat, and also, could he buy you a drink? "You should really do this battle of the bands," Mutt said. "I think we need to start thinking bigger than just the Bay Area." "Oh, do we?" Joelle said. She was pretty reluctant about the whole thing, as you could probably imagine. But Iris, lead guitar, voice of reason, had this family cabin that we could all stay at up by the lake a couple miles from the old abandoned government testing facility, and it kind of seemed like a fun excuse to get out of the city. We piled into Clay's van, all of us except for Mutt, who he made sure we knew wanted to come, but he had a work thing he couldn't get out of, which was totally fine by us because Joelle made sure he knew Mutt wasn't in the band. We got to the cabin pretty late and immediately started drinking out by the fire pit. After a couple beers, I noticed Lizzie had wandered into the house. I found her in the kitchen, leaning against the counter and peeling the label off her beer bottle. "What's going on? Every time you drink, you get all weird and sullen," I said. "Don't be weird and sullen, Lizzie." She shook her head and tried not to look at me. She scrunched up her face and waved me off, the futile kind of, "I don't want to bother you with my troubles" gesture you make at a good friend who you know wants nothing more than to be bothered with your troubles. "Lizzie, what is it?" "Kathleen and I broke up." "Oh my God, are you okay?" "I'm fine," she said unfinely. She pulled another beer from the fridge. "What happened?" "I don't know. I just keep thinking it's not supposed to be this hard, you know, but I always make it hard. Then again, maybe it's her fault because she broke the first rule of rock and roll." "What's that?" I watched her fumble with the latch on the screen door, and as she pushed out into the night, she shouted back at me, "Never fall in love with that bass player!" I followed her back to the fire. Joelle raised an eyebrow. "Where were you two?" "Yeah," said Clay. He had taken Iris's acoustic guitar and he started half singing to himself as he strummed. "Where were you two?" "We were just talking," I said. "Well, I'm glad you're back," said Iris, "because I actually have something I want to give you all." She grabbed her backpack and pulled out these hemp necklaces she'd made for all of us, each with a single blue bead she'd gotten from the strange mystic who lived in the apartment below her and was always stinking up the place with weird incense and taxidermied roadkill. Welcome to San Francisco. We all put the necklaces on. But this started a whole conversation once again about what kind of band we were. At this point, we're really getting pretty expert at starting conversations about what kind of band we were and could probably get it going from just about anything. "So that's what we are now, a band that wears matching necklaces?" "Come on, Joelle. What, no one else thinks that's super corny?" Still noodling on the guitar, Clay sang, "Oh, I don't even know why we're having this conversation about necklaces when meanwhile we're still playing songs we wrote 3 years ago." "Bands play old songs, Clay. Bands do that."
"Okay, but everyone just heard Iris say do, right?"
"Yeah, but I don't want to be just a band, you know? Like, don't you guys ever dream of something more?"
Suddenly a bolt of lightning shot down from the clear black sky, hitting Lizzie's necklace and ricocheting off our 5 blue beads, knocking us back into the woods, scattering us into the dead leaves like eraser shavings across a page. "Is everyone okay?" I shouted. "Okay-ish," said Iris, stumbling as soon as she stood up. She rested a hand on a rock and the whole ground kind of shook, and then like 10 feet away a little tree fell over. "Emphasis on the ish," said Joelle. She was floating 3 feet in the air. Her eyes looked like they were on fire. "So, I don't know if it was the lightning or the mystic's beads or our proximity to the old abandoned government testing facility or the fact that we were all drunk or if this is just a thing that happens sometimes, but we all got superpowers that night. Again, I really don't want to harp on the superpowers part of it all. I'd hate to think that the fact that I could now shoot photon blasts out of my fist was like the most interesting thing about me as opposed to, I don't know, my sparkling personality. But there were 2 basic rules to the superpowers. 1, we had to wear our necklaces with the blue beads in order for our powers to work. And 2, we had to be drunk. And the drunker we got, the more powerful we became. When we got back down to the city, there was some talk about maybe starting up some sort of superhero team, but honestly, it all seemed like a lot of to-do. I just feel like the whole using our powers for good thing is kind of a cliche at this point, said Joelle. Lead Vokes, fire laser eyes, flight. Like, what are we supposed to do? Just wander the streets waiting until we see someone get mugged? It doesn't seem like the best use of our time. But then Iris, lead guitar, kinetic vibration, teleportation, gave this really stirring speech about, like, responsibility and all that and what it means to be a citizen of this universe and the social contract or whatever. I wish I could remember it better because it sounds super hokey when I paraphrase it, but it really was a pretty great speech. Super inspiring, and it totally made you feel like everything happened for a reason and there was a noble thread sewn into the tapestry of your narrative, and just by existing in this world, you were a part of something wonderful. But I don't know, maybe you kind of had to be there. So then we were superheroes for a while, and that was a whole thing. I don't remember all of it, the superhero stuff, because it was kind of a lot, and I was fantastically drunk during most of the important parts, but it comes back in sparks and flashes those nights. It was broken bottle in the street nights, busted nose from a 50-foot fall, kind of 3-day weekends. It was nights of stumbling, falling, laughing, shouting, punching, crawling, screaming, crying, leaping, flying, living, drinking, singing, drinking. We wrestled angels, real honest-to-God fallen angels all fucked up on amphetamines, and we battled sea creatures as tall as the Transamerica Pyramid and stayed up all night shooting the shit about fucking nothing and fucked groupies and stopped bank robberies and did interviews where reporters would ask questions like, is it true you're impenetrable? And Joelle would get real close to the tape recorder and without breaking eye contact with the interviewer say, I can't speak for the others, but I've been penetrated hundreds of times. We get mobbed by the press, microphones shoved in our faces, flashbulbs exploding, stopped in the street on our way to save the world. How do you stay humble? And wiping the whiskey off our lips, we'd stumble leap into flight or something like it toward whatever next adventure and shout back behind us, we don't! Joelle's harem of admirers went from half a dozen to a couple hundred seemingly overnight. Pretty girls would spill up to Clay in bars and diners and say, hey, are you one of the up-and-comers? And Clay, drums, cowbell, molecular absorption of the kinetic energy and physical density of objects, would smirk and say something super cheesy like, well, I'm up, but I'm not coming. But Lizzie was the worst. She'd go right up to them, these women, sitting alone or with friends or with their girlfriends or even boyfriends, husbands, it didn't matter. She'd go up and say, hey, what are you doing with this guy? Here's the deal. I'm hella good in bed, I play bass guitar, and I have the power of spooky hexagons. You want to get out of here? Meanwhile, there was always a villain to battle, a lawsuit to settle, a licensing agreement to negotiate. Mutt Wang quit his job and started working for us full-time as our business manager. I don't know what we would have done without Mutt, really. I don't. Like, how are superheroes supposed to stay in the black, especially superheroes who are drunk all the time and constantly knocking over buildings? Mutt rented a space for us downtown that we could use as our base of operations, and in her spare time, Iris converted it into a interdimensional hellosphere. So, you know when your favorite band signs onto a major label and it's exciting and you're happy for them, but then their new album comes out and it sounds overproduced and super poppy and you sort of forget what made them special in the first place? Well, I hate to say it because it's such a cliche at this point, but that's kind of what happened to us with the introduction of the interdimensional holosphere. Suddenly, we were traveling to distant moons and hypothetical worlds and battling even worse guys with worms for heads and arms for legs and dimensions within dimensions. But even with all the craziness going on around us, we tried to keep our feet on the ground, or if not on the ground, then at least on one of Lizzie's spooky hexagons, and remember who we were. One time, Clay was so drunk he could barely stand, beaten to an inch of his life by Dorjak the Destroyer, vomited onto the ragged plains of Earth 12, an entire pitcher of raspberry mojito, and while absorbing the kinetic energy of the fossilized ancient heart of an alien warrior king, turned to me, smiled dumbly, and asked, "Hey, who do you think will be the first one of us to get married?" Turned out, it was Joelle, breaking a couple thousand hearts with the wedding announcement. "I only have fire laser eyes for you." She had a pretty sweet wedding, too, except for the part where the DJ wouldn't play Cotton Eye Joe, no matter how many times Lizzie and I requested it, and also the part where the Shadow Man attacked us right in the middle of the cake cutting, which, if you ask me, was a super dick move. Well, we all got wasted real fast and defeated the Shadow Man and his lemming army again, but the wedding was more or less ruined, and Joelle's husband, Sam, was really upset. "I just wanted one day that wasn't about you and your superhero friends. One day that was about us." What I mostly remember from that time are the talks. Long conversations with Iris about truth and justice and society. And bitch sessions with Joelle about which supervillains were actually kind of cute and which ones were total dicks. And lazy rambling powwows with Lizzie holed up in diners and bars until 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 in the morning. Frothy mixes of inside jokes and bittersweet reveries over exes and philosophical quandaries and mumbled ponderings over what does it take to get some goddamn service in this place. Lizzie was the first person I told when Mutt Wang asked me out. "Mutt? Mutt? My Mutt?" Lizzie cackled out a mouthful of cornflakes. "What did you tell him?" I shrugged. "I said I'd think about it." Lizzie nodded thoughtfully. "You should hella go out with him, Porkchop. You could use a stabilizing force in your life." "Oh, I need a stabilizing force? Should we drill down into your love life? That hardly seems relevant. Are you finding deep emotional fulfillment in the parade of bimbos you take home?" "They're not bimbos!" I'm sorry. "The parade of scintillating conversationalists, the paragons of wit and class." Lizzie crossed her arms. "There's nothing less attractive in a woman than the hatred of other women." I rolled my eyes and performed the international symbol for jerking off. "Oh, I'm devastated you don't find me attractive. Truly, it keeps me up at night." Lizzie smiled. "For real, though, you should go out with Mutt. You like Mutt." "You don't know who I like." "I know everything about you. Besides, when was the last time you dated a guy? If you don't do something with a penis in the next..." She looked at her watch. "Week and a half? I think they're going to take away your bi card." I laughed. "Is that how it works? Because that is super cisnormative." "Don't change the subject." "What subject?" She leaned in. "I think you might be a full-blown lesbian, Porkchop." "What are you, the welcoming committee?" "Are you kidding? I already have to compete with Iris. I'm trying to get you off the market here." Oh, now I see what this is about. "I am 100% looking out for my interests. Was that not clear?" "Okay, but what if Mutt and I go out and it's weird and then he's still our manager so I have to see him all the time? Or what if it's not weird? What if it's great, but then later it's weird?" Lizzie grabbed the flask out of my purse and poured some vodka into her coffee. "Do you ever think maybe you're overthinking things?" So I went out with Mutt. He took me to this super schmancy place up in Marin. I told him about how I was trying to teach myself guitar, and he asked me if he could come back to my apartment and hear me play something, which I thought was a pretty bold move. I had intentionally not cleaned my apartment before the date, the thinking being that if my apartment was messy, I wouldn't bring Mutt home, a kind of advanced not shaving my legs technique. But then I brought him home anyway, so shows what I know. I'd written this dopey love song for no one in particular, but it didn't really feel ready to play for anyone. And besides, it felt like if I played it for Mutt, then I would really be saying something. And I didn't think I wanted to do that. Instead, I played a Fleetwood Mac song. I think I did a pretty crummy job of it. I must have missed, like, half a dozen chords, but Mutt didn't seem to notice, or he pretended not to notice, which I thought was pretty annoying either way, because if he really couldn't tell, did we really want this guy to be our manager? And if he was just pretending I did a good job in order to be nice to me, then that was pretty condescending. But then, anyway, Mutt and I had sex.
The next morning, Lizzie immediately cornered me in the Hellosphere kitchenette. "How was the sex?" she asked. I choked on my yogurt. "Did Mutt tell you we had sex?" "Nope, you did." I rolled my eyes. "If you could interrogate evil henchmen half as well as you interrogate me." Lizzie smiled at me. "Congratulations, Porkchop. Your chops have been thoroughly porked. I'm proud of you." I did my best impression of Lizzie's trademark who gives a shit scowl. "So what about you? Are you gonna find someone?" "I find people all the time." "Yeah, but that's just because you don't care about any of them. I'd like to see you around a girl you actually liked. I bet you'd be the biggest fucking moron in the world." She didn't say anything. She just looked at me and sipped her coffee. So then I was 24 for a year, and that was a whole thing. It was fun for a little bit, being 24. In that way that all things are fun for a little bit, but at a certain point, it started to dawn on me that as time passed, we were playing music less and less and blacking out more and more, and it seemed like the longer we'd been doing this, the more alcohol it took to get our powers going, and every time we defeated this deposed alien viceroy or that disgruntled mutant dolphin, there'd be some other thing just waiting to take its shot at us, and it started to feel like, is this really why any of us got into this in the first place? One time, Clay asked me if I'd ever thought about quitting. "I mean, we're in our mid-20s. Doesn't it feel kind of too old already to still be fucking around, getting drunk every day and battling psycho lizard beasts? Like, are we still going to be doing this when we're 40? I had to admit he had a point, but frankly, I wasn't really good at anything else. "Besides," he said lightly, "there are only so many times you can beat up a guy before it starts to mess you up in the head." He chuckled to himself, awkwardly, sadly. "Clay," I said, "those guys we beat up, those are bad guys." And he said, "I know." And he fiddled self-consciously with the bead on his necklace. But whenever I would talk to Mutt, who was, I guess, my boyfriend now, about cutting back on the whole superhero thing, he would get really passionate about how this was my calling or whatever. And so if you get the opportunity to do what I did, and I would be crazy to walk away from all that. "And besides," he would say, "what am I supposed to do if you guys all suddenly stop being superheroes?" And I don't know if I was ever convinced, not 100%, but I knew that he really cared. And I guess I figured that sometimes being in a relationship meant doing things you weren't totally on board with for the sake of making the other person happy. "Also," he would say, "I need you to sign these forms. This is a standard licensing agreement." And I loved Mutt in that way that you love something when you're at a place in your life when you're ready to love something and there's a thing there that you can love. And I still had that dumb little love song I wrote that I was teaching myself how to play on the guitar that I performed for no one. Sometimes I would practice it while Mutt was in the shower and he'd come out and say, "What were you singing just now?" And I'd say, "Nothing." And it felt good to have a thing that was mine and mine alone. And I enjoyed being in the band, and I did think what we were doing was important, but more and more often, someone would get sloppy with the math and land on the wrong side of plastered. We'd be fighting the Osmonaut, and in the midst of battle, Clay would just start checking his phone for text messages, and it was like, "Hey, can we focus here?" Some nights, instead of going home, Joelle would drink herself to sleep on a couch at the Hellosphere, and the next morning, when one of us would ask her if everything was okay with her and Sam, she'd say, "I'm fine. It's just, I spend so much time here anyway, and Sam and I live all the way in Berkeley, and it's such a hassle trying to get over the bridge." Which kind of made sense, but also, on the other hand, Joel could fly, so I didn't really get why rush hour traffic would be a going concern for her. And then there was the time Lizzie and I were holed up in an air duct in the Cybercorp building trying to figure out how to bring down the mad goddess Suspira, who had just assembled all the proto-universe crystals into an unstoppable power scepter, when Lizzie suddenly got all sullen and antisocial and just looked at her feet and mumbled, "What's the point? I mean, what's even the point of anything?" And I said, "Lizzie, this is not the time for this. Did you drink red wine? You can't do that. You get all sad and sleepy." "I saw Kathleen," she slurred. "Did I tell you I saw Kathleen?" I shook my head. "I've been trying to get in touch with her. And for a while, she was just ignoring me. But then after I saved that little girl from the sentient BART train last week, finally Kathleen agreed to meet up." "Lizzie, that's huge!" Through the slats of the air duct, I could see Suspira loading her power scepter into Cybercorp's time vibration laser. "So I saw her last night, and I told her, you know, Kathleen, I'm still in love with you. I didn't mean to say it. I wasn't planning on saying it, but it just,
She was getting really worked up, and I motioned at her to lower her voice. She did not lower her voice. I said, I know I wasn't always there for you, but things were so crazy then, and I did a lot of work. You know, I'm not that girl anymore. But she was just like, you are that girl. That's the whole point. That's who you are, Lizzie. The whole building started shaking as the time vibration laser powered on. I said, hey, do you think maybe we could talk about this later? I'm totally invested in this story, and I definitely want to hear about it, but you know, the laser and everything. And you want to know the worst part? The crystals on Suspira's scepter started lighting up one by one, and Lizzie leaned in close and whispered through a cloud from her low breath, the worst part is she's right. Jesus Christ, Lizzie, I get that you're sad, but I can't be your fucking babysitter right now. There are bigger things to deal with. If we don't stop the time vibration laser, it could destroy the planet. You mean the planet where Kathleen lives? Kathleen's precious planet? I rolled my eyes. This is not a good color on you. She shrugged. What do you want from me? I'm no hero. I'm Miss Lizzie. Yeah, okay. You're Lizzie, and I think you're fucking awesome. I, for one, adore Lizzie. She's the bee's fucking knees, but if you don't get it together and help me stop the mad goddess Suspira from firing her crystal-powered laser, then that means Kathleen was right about you. What? No. Don't you get it? If all of humanity is destroyed in a fiery time holocaust that you couldn't stop, Kathleen wins. That's fucked up. Lizzie exploded out of the air duct and in one swift move cut off the energy of the power scepter and pinned Suspira against the wall with some spooky hexagons. Later back on the ground, when Iris was explaining to the press what had happened exactly, Lizzie had sobered up a little and she gave me a bashful kind of shrug, like she was saying thanks and sorry and thanks again all at once. And I shook my head at her, like, of course. Mutt climbed through the crowd of bystanders and grabbed my arm. Thank God you're okay. He wrapped his arms around me and kissed me like people do in the movies. I was a little self-conscious kissing Mutt like that in front of the cameras and everybody, but Mutt said it was good to show everybody that we had personal lives. It humanized us, Mutt said. We were all pretty jazzed up after that battle, but when we got back to the Hellsphere, Joelle's husband was waiting for us. Sam, Joelle said in that way you say someone's name that you haven't said in a while. And Sam shook his head. No. Don't come near me. It is not okay. You get drunk with your friends and then you come home. Joelle looked at the rest of us. Guys, do you think maybe we could have a minute? Nobody leave, Sam said. I don't want to be alone with you ever again, not after what you did. What I did? Sam, you know what you did. Or is forgetting another one of your superpowers. I swear, I don't know what you're talking about. Do you want me to say it? Don't make me say it. Can we talk about this? Do you want me to say what you did in front of all your friends? I probably should. I probably should go straight to the media and tell the whole world. Is that what you want? You really want me to say what you did? Joelle swallowed hard. No, I know it. I know what I did. Sam's face fell, as if hearing Joelle admit the thing out loud suddenly made it a different kind of true. Then Joelle started to say something, but Sam cut her off. I want you to stay away from me. Do you understand? You need to stay as far away from me as you can get. Don't call me. Don't call my friends. Do you understand? This is over. He took off his wedding ring. He was shaking. Sam, tell me you understand. I understand. And there's nothing else to say. And he left. There was a long pause before Clay said, awkward, and we all kind of said, shut up, Clay. We watched Joelle stumble toward the kitchen and I grab a handle of gin out from under the sink and start chugging it. Joelle, is that really a good... Not now, Iris. I can't take another one of your fucking speeches right now. I need to get away for a little while, get some air. She weaved toward the window. Joelle, I really don't think you should be alone right now. No, I just need some air, that's all. I need some air. And we all watched her drop out the window and then a second later shoot straight up past it into the sky. Iris grabbed a gin of her own from behind a couch cushion, but Lizzie said, let her go. She just needs to blow off some steam. I'm sure she'll be fine. And I said, yeah, she'll be fine. Well, she died. There were conflicting reports about what happened exactly. She went on a tear through all the bars in Berkeley, and after she died, 1,000 drunkards came out of the woodwork claiming to be the last person who saw Joelle alive. Some said she was depressed, rambling. Others said she was jubilant, euphoric, buying shots for the whole bar, tossing bottles in the air, and blasting them with her fire laser eyes.
We do know how she spent her last moments, though. The autopsy confirmed it. She flew straight up into the night sky as far as she could go, as far away from everything as she could get, and then when the air got too thin to breathe, she passed out, and gravity dragged her tumbling back down to Earth.
You'd think that might have been some kind of come-to-Jesus moment for the rest of us, Joel dying. But we were all drinking at her funeral, passing miniature bottles of schnapps behind the pews. So now the parents' counsel for appropriate responsible behavior or whatever was suddenly up our butts because we weren't good role models for kids because we were drinking all the time. But it was just like, dude, we're not trying to be good role models. We're just trying to keep the streets safe. And my parents were calling every week, like, are you as drunk as they say you are on the news? And I always had to convince them, no, Mom. You know, they just make stuff up to get a good story. And meanwhile, there were all these new superheroes getting all the good write-ups, like A-Man and the Silver Bullets and Captain Boo from the planet Goo. Younger guys who would do even crazier shit than we did. And I guess people started to think of the up-and-comers as being kind of old hat. Mutt and I were in bed watching some dumb late-night show.
Don't you think it's about time they changed their name to the Down and Outers?
When Mutt said, we need to shift the narrative here. Give the press something positive they can focus on. Like what? What if we got married? We were a mile above Chinatown fighting the mayor's evil android hordes when I casually brought up that Mutt had asked me to marry him. Everybody was really happy for me, except for Lizzie. No, you can't marry Mutt. That's crazy. Stranger things have happened, I said as I tore the metallic heart out of a nearby flying goon with my mystical bead-based super strength. Besides, you're the one who told me to go out with him in the first place. Yeah, but you can't marry him. I mean, Mutt's a great guy, but he's not the guy you marry. And Clay said, hey, do you guys think the mayor's really gone evil this time, or is this just another one of his clones? But Lizzie, all high and mighty on her spooky hexagons, would not be distracted. You don't love him, Porkchop. I'm telling you, this isn't what you want. What is your deal? Why can't you ever just be happy for me, I asked, as I held one of the androids in a headlock and kicked another one in the face. Why do you always have to know, like, a better way for me to live my life? And Iris said, guys, can we focus? And Lizzie said, Porkchop, I'm just trying to... I don't know why you fucking call me Porkchop all the time. It's not my name and it isn't cute. Lizzie stopped shooting spooky hexagons at the androids for a moment and looked at me. Okay. I'm sorry. But it wasn't an I'm sorry, I'm sorry. It was an I can't believe you're making me say I'm sorry, I'm sorry. No, I said, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You can't figure out your own life, so you constantly try to control mine. What the fuck? I'm not trying to control anything. I'm just trying to be a good friend, you dumb asshole, because I think the fucking world of you and I want you to be happy. And I said, well, great. Thank you for your friendship. You've always been a wonderful pillar of support. And then the last of the androids said, prepare for doom, before Iris blew it to pieces by teleporting inside of it. We dropped down onto the street and waved to the applauding tourists and Chinese shopkeepers, and Lizzie muttered to me, you know, it actually makes a lot of sense that you'd marry Mutt. Of course you're going to marry him because that's what Mutt wants, and you would never in your life make a decision for yourself. You are way out of line. Are you just going to keep on stumbling down the path of least resistance all your life? Is that your plan? Jesus Christ, you've become a total fucking bore. I shot a photon blast at her, which knocked her back into a fish stand. She got up and rolled her eyes. Oh, real mature. You're real mature, I said. Fine, she said. Enjoy your fucking married life with your fucking husband and your fucking house in the fucking suburbs with your fucking white fucking picket fucking fence fucking fucking. She threw her arms up and started walking away, and I shouted at her, hey, excuse me for trying to actually build a life for myself instead of just using this whole superhero thing as an excuse to get drunk and pick up groupies like a fucking bass guitarist cliche. She turned around and shot a spooky hexagon at me, and then I shot a photon blast at her, and then we were in the middle of Chinatown shooting photon blasts and spooky hexagons at each other. And then we were wrestling, grabbing at each other's throats, throwing each other down Stockton, tearing across the shops and restaurants through a mess of cheap fans and plastic shoes and Chinese yo-yos. Clay and Iris had to physically separate us. We were so mad. On the limo ride to City Hall, where we were to be rewarded with another round of medals for our valor, I muttered under my breath, look, don't take it out on me just because you're still in love with some chick who will never love you back. Lizzie shook her head. Jesus Christ, she said. You really don't know me at all. Then Lizzie and I didn't talk for, like, a long time.
Like, we'd still be civil with each other at press events, or, like, when we had to work together to save the president's daughter or whatever, but we didn't talk. So that was a whole thing. One day, we were all not talking to each other in the Hellosphere kitchenette when Mutt practically dragged Clay in by the ear. "Tell him," said Mutt. "Tell everyone what you did." Clay rolled his eyes. "Oh, boy," said Iris. "What did you do this time?"
"Look, sometimes I get aggressive, okay? Like, first of all, can I just say it's not normal what we do, what we're expected to do.
Are you going to tell them, or should I?"
"I'm getting to it, Jesus. So I've spent the last couple years getting myself into this mindset, you know, pumping myself up, absorbing all this kinetic energy so I can do what everybody wants me to do when I have this aggression."
"There's a video on the internet," said Mutt, "of Clay absorbing a rum bottle and then smashing his glass fist over a guy's head for cutting him in line at the grocery store."
"Jesus, Clay! What? Who say he wasn't being controlled by the phantom ventriloquist? I mean, we don't know, right?"
"You can't just go around," I started to say, but then Mutt cut me off.
"It's a Bacardi bottle."
"And?"
"Clay absorbed a bottle of Bacardi. We have an exclusive endorsement deal with Captain Morgan. Do any of you read the contracts you sign?"
Clay waved him off.
"It's really not a big deal."
"It is a big deal. It's their biggest competitor and the video is everywhere. What were you thinking?"
Lizzie raised a finger. Is anyone else more concerned about what Clay did to the guy at the grocery store than what it's going to do to our Captain Morgan deal?"
"It's not just Captain Morgan," Mutt sputtered. "You are paid to be brand ambassadors. That is the source of our income, and brands can't trust you to do that. I mean, this is the reason you exist."
Normally, this would be the point of the conversation when Iris would say something really smart and make us all realize the right thing to do. But instead, she wandered over to the corner of the room where we kept a set of instruments, picked up her guitar, and started strumming. She was playing not hardly. Lizzie picked up her guitar and started playing too. Then Clay got behind the drums and I sat at the piano and the up-and-comers were playing together for the first time in what must have been forever. It felt a little eerie playing the song without Joel there to sing it, especially when Iris and Lizzie jumped in and shouted their backup parts on the chorus, the "Oh, I do's" and "Yes, it's true's." But still, there was something incredibly powerful about everyone just shutting up for a second and playing a song together. After we finished, we all just stood there in silence, and then Iris said very simply, "Yeah, I'm gonna go."
"What do you mean go? Go where?"
Iris put down her guitar and put her hands on her hips, indicating she was prepping her body for teleportation.
"The iniquity of our world is too systemic to be ameliorated by tackling only the most flagrant of abuses," she declared.
She always loved using big words when she got drunk.
"I think there are more effectual ways to spend our time and resources than fistfighting aliens."
Her eyes clouded over. "But where are you going?"
"I don't know."
And then she added, almost as an afterthought, as she evaporated into nothingness,
"Maybe I'll go to grad school."
Clay shook his head.
"Of course Iris would flake out on us like that. This is bullshit. This whole goddamn thing is a high fucking tower of bullshit."
He absorbed the density of the marble countertop, punched a hole in the wall, and headed out toward the weight room. Mutt immediately went into full damage control mode.
"Okay," he started spinning, "a press release. If Clay won't apologize, we need to distance ourselves, protect the organization. Talking points. His actions do not represent the et cetera of the up-and-comers, the ideals."
I took off my necklace, the source of all my power, and placed it on the counter. "I think I'm done," I said. "I think the up-and-comers are done."
Mutt shook his head. "Honey, no, you're a superhero. That's what you do."
"It's not worth it," I said.
"So what am I supposed to do?"
Mutt pulled a contract out of his briefcase and pointed to an underlined string of legalese.
"If you stop performing consistent acts of public heroism, we are in breach. Is that what you want? For us to get married and immediately fall into the red? You and me, without jobs, scrambling to stay out of debt like every other fucking schmo on the planet? Is that the life you want?"
"No," I said. "It isn't." I took off my engagement ring. I tried to crush it between my fingers, but I no longer had the strength. So instead, I just put it down on the counter next to my necklace and left.
"Wait,"
said Mutt.
"You can't just walk away."
But as it turned out, I could do all sorts of incredible things. Lizzie followed me out of the building. Hey, she said, and I turned around.
You were right. Is that what you want to hear? I never should have gotten engaged to Mutt. You were right. You're always right. Is that what you want me to say?
Lizzie shook her head. Haven't you learned by now that I never know what the fuck I'm talking about? I laughed. You know, you could have told me that 3 years ago and saved us both a lot of time. Are you okay? She asked.
I think so,
I said. I mean, the hard part's over, right? And she said, yeah, the hard part's over.
Well, the next 6 months were incredibly hard, what with all the lawsuits and countersuits and breaches of contract and all that. I feel like in those 6 months I probably spent more time in depositions than not in depositions. I lost my apartment in the city and moved back to my parents' house in Tulsa for a little bit, just long enough to get back on my feet. It was nice to get away from things for a second, to spend some time with my family and dry out a little. I did some temp work at my dad's office and volunteered at the children's theater, playing piano for their various Guys and Dollses and Damn Yankeeses. As Lizzie would say, time stumbles on in time's dumbass way. There were certain things I missed about the city. I missed the pancakes at Boogaloo's and hikes up to Land's End. I missed propelling myself with photon blasts high up above the city to watch the sunset. Sometimes it felt like if I got myself high enough, the sun would never dip below the horizon. But of course it always did. But mostly I missed Lizzie and all our stupid conversations about nothing in diners and how when I was around her, I didn't dislike her. I liked me. Lizzie actually came to visit me a couple weeks ago. She was driving across the country, taking her aunt's car to North Carolina, and she stopped in Tulsa, and we got a coffee at Foolish Things. It was good to see Lizzie. Hanging out with her took me back in a weird sort of way, like it made me feel both young and old at the same time. It was really trippy to think there was a time, not all that long ago, when the most important thing in the world seemed to be stopping Dr. Tormentus from unlocking the cosmic power of the Supremacy Belt. Like, it felt like if we could just do that, then maybe everything would be okay. Like, man, how young were we, right? After coffee, Lizzie had a couple hours to kill before her AA meeting, so I brought her back to my parents' house. Since when do you play this? She asked, nodding at the guitar in my room. I picked it up. See, you think you know everything about me, but there's actually a lot you don't know. Lizzie dropped onto my bed and smiled. Of course you would keep this a secret. Has anyone ever told you you're incredible? I rolled my eyes. Only everybody. Play me something. I started tuning. What do you want me to play? Why don't you play me something you wrote? No, I don't want to do that. Hey, how come you never wrote any songs for the band? Were you holding out on us? I concentrated on my tuning. I didn't need to write songs. Everyone else wrote songs. That's right, she said. I wrote songs. Joelle wrote songs. How come you never brought in any songs? I don't know. I just didn't. I bet you wrote some good ones. You just never brought them in. No. Lizzie leaned back against the headboard and closed her eyes. Play me one of your songs, Lauren. I remember one time I asked Iris if she was afraid to die. This was when we were trapped in the man-pig pit of Dimension K, and it really looked like we might not make it home. Iris said, afraid or not, it didn't really matter. That the thing about death is that it's terrifying and overwhelming, and it can happen at any moment. And when you're confronted with death, we can either be cowardly or we can be brave. But either way, we're gonna die, so... And I thought, whoa, that's dark. But here I was, sitting in my childhood bedroom with a guitar. The up-and-comers were over and done, and it was just Lizzie and me, and it was the afternoon, and it was summer in Tulsa, and Lizzie was lying on my bed, looking as calm and beautiful as I'd ever seen her, and she was asking me to play her something I had written. And I thought about how, actually, if you wanted to, you could say the same thing about life. That life is terrifying and overwhelming, and it can happen at any moment. And when you're confronted with life, you can either be cowardly or you can be brave. But either way, you're gonna live. So you might as well be brave.
Move Across the Country, read by Coleman Domingo. Move across the country and hope the sadness won't find you, won't follow you like a stray dog from coast to coast. Hope the sadness isn't just a fog on a leash, shadowing you always. Hope the sadness can't be as fleet as you are. Hope the sadness is more rooted. Perhaps the sadness has friends, a family, and can't just pick up and go. Look at all this stuff the sadness has here in San Jose or Chapel Hill or wherever you're currently leaving. How's the sadness going to survive without all this stuff? Hope this isn't one of those any place I hang my hat is home type situations where the sadness hangs its hat on you. Hope that you are not the sadness's home. Anywhere you go, no matter how far, no matter how quickly, the sadness lives in you. Hope to God it's not that. Move across the country and start a new adventure. Create a brand new life. Buy a new set of furniture, a fresh autumn coat. Fill your days with distraction. Take a class. Learn an instrument. Visit your local library and crack open one of those Bronte sisters you always meant to get acquainted with. Anything to make the days pass faster, to accumulate distance, to get you as far away as possible from the day that you left. Move across the country and watch the short yellow lines shoot past you down the pavement. See the city recede in the distance behind the taped-up boxes obstructing your rear view. Settle somewhere fertile. Plant a new you and watch you blossom. You can barely remember that old you now, the you who lived in that other place and was sad. That old you wasn't you. This is you. This is the you you want to be. You have friends now, a routine, a coffee shop where someone, as you saunter in, smiles and says the usual. One night at a bar late, you pick up a hobby of a person that somehow grows into a habit, a person whose flaws sparkle off yours in glorious coruscating patterns, a person who gets to know not just the you sometimes show, but the you truly are, a person who, when you weren't looking, slipped a naked, wounded heart into the pocket of your jacket with a bow and a note that said, "Handle with care." One night, you will wake with a start in this person's bed. You will discover yourself in this person's arms, and you will disentangle yourself for the 100th time and dress yourself for the 100th time and try to leave this person's apartment. But when you get to the door, there'll be a sticky note over the knob that says, "But what if this time you stayed?" And you will turn around and get back into that person's bed. And you will get back into that person's arms, and you will stay there for a year and a half, and you will learn how to be very, very tender with that person's naked, wounded heart. And when the sadness catches up, tracks you down, when you return home one day, arms full of groceries, to find the sadness sitting at the kitchen table, casually reading a paper as if it never left, eating a muffin as if this were all perfectly natural, when the sadness looks up at you and says, "What did you think, buddy? What did you think was going to happen?" When the sadness smirks at you and says with a wry insistence that unravels you in an instant, "This is the real love story here, buddy. You and me." When the sadness reiterates that, sure, certain smaller sadnesses dull, but this sadness, the sadness, has seen you through it all. This sadness, the sadness, has never strayed from your side, not really. And why would you want it to now? This epitome of stability in an inconsistent world. When that happens, you can put your groceries down and walk back out the door and close the door behind you. You can get in your car and drive all night and call your person from the road and say, "I'm sorry." You can keep driving until you hit a help wanted sign dangling off the edge of the opposite coast. You can take a new job and get all your stuff shipped out to you, or thrown in the garbage, or thrown in the river, or burned in a fire, or donated to the Goodwill. Go for a hike along the water and breathe in the fresh sea air. Move across the country and start again someplace new.
You want to know what plays are like? Read by Emma Galvin. Here's my impression of a play. Okay, so first you gotta imagine it's a hotel room, right? Just a normal, boring-looking hotel room, on the nice end of things, as far as hotel rooms go. And the audience is coming in, and they're taking their seats in this dinky little theater in Lower Manhattan, barely bigger than a Winnebago, this theater. With seats that feel like someone just glued down some thin fabric over a block of hard metal. The main thing of a theater, like the whole point of it, is that there's going to be a lot of sitting in it. So you'd think they would at least consider investing in some comfortable chairs. Word to the wise, if they can't even get that part right, which absolutely most of the time they cannot, then buckle the fuck up. Because I can tell you right now, you are in for an ordeal of an evening. Anyway, the people are walking down the aisle, trying to find their row, which is pretty much impossible because even though there are only three rows in the theater, they're labeled like row A, row JJ, and row 2A and a half. And everyone's looking at their ticket like, I'm supposed to be in row 12? Where the hell is 12? But anyway, they're walking down the aisle, and the carpet has a weird bump in it that everyone needs to be careful not to trip over. And they sit down, and they look at the stage, and they see a bed and a chair and a minibar, and they say, okay, so I guess this play takes place in a hotel room. Half of all plays ever written take place in hotel rooms, just about. So it's not a huge shock. And half of those are about guys on business trips spilling their guts to hookers who, it turns out, are actually really sweet. This play is not about that. But for a second, it feels like it could be. Like when the audience comes in and they see the hotel room, they have to check their programs because it's like, oh shit, is this going to be another one of those plays about a sad guy and a sensitive hooker? And the guy doesn't even want to have sex with her. He just wants to talk. But then later, they have sex anyway and she doesn't even charge him because it turns out they fell in love. And of course the hooker takes her bra off right when she's facing the audience. God, this isn't going to be one of those plays, is it? So then everyone's looking at the program, right? To try to figure out whether it's one of those hooker plays. And they're reading the notes from the artistic director or whatever, and the cast bios, and it's like, oh, did you see this actress played a dead body on a Law and Order once? And there's a thing in the back about how we need you to donate money to the theater. Like how theater is so vital and important. Like as if you didn't spend your money already on a ticket just to be here. Like as if they're doing you a favor to show you this play. Like as if the playwriter's parents hadn't already spent thousands of dollars to send this guy to a fancy liberal arts college so he could learn how to write plays good. As if his big sister didn't just drive all the way down from Syracuse to be here, leaving the kids with her dirtbag ex-husband, who you just know is going to say some dumb shit that traumatizes them while she's gone. Or he's going to show them a dead cat in the alley or some old wrestling videos or something. And when she gets back, she's going to get a call from the school because her kids won't stop meat hooking and pile driving everybody. But anyway, the play. So the lights go down, and the fancy play bellhop comes to the front of the audience to make an announcement. And the announcement is basically, hey, dummies, turn off your cell phones, you're at a play! But then also maybe there's a part about how this theater company has more plays coming up, and if you like plays, maybe you could buy tickets to see more of them! And it's just like, Jesus, play. Maybe for one second, you could stop trying to sell me on the concept of plays. If I want to see more theater, I know how to do it. But anyway, I don't even really live here. I'm just trying to be a good older sister to my idiot playwriter brother, who, by the way, couldn't even get me into this play for free. This is another true fact about plays, which is that on top of everything else, you have to pay for your own ticket. Because I guess that's what being supportive is. Because I guess if you're not buying a ticket, who is? Mom and Dad? Yeah, right. As the fancy play bellhop walks back up the aisle, stumbling over the weird bump in the carpet, you look around at your fellow audience members in this half-empty theater, and you wonder if the only reason any play is ever successful at all is just on account of friends and family being supportive. So then the play starts, and the first thing that happens is two ladies burst into the hotel room, one after another. These ladies are supposed to be sisters, probably, because when plays aren't about hookers, 90% of the time they're about sisters. But of course, because it's a play, these sisters look nothing alike. For starters, one of them's like 50 and the other one's like 20, because apparently when you're hiring people for plays, it's impossible to find two women who are about the same age. The older one goes right for the mini fridge and pulls out a bottle of white wine, even though since it's a play, the white wine is actually water. If there's even something in the bottle at all, which...